Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast, along with J.J. Cooper. I'm John Manuel. J.J. showing me my Hickory Daily Record pencil. You know, I've been here a long time. I still have my 16-year-old pencil from the Hickory Daily Record. Long time ago that I worked there.
No, I'll put it this way. No one's stealing that pencil without you.
No, it just lies around in here, and nobody ever takes my Hickory Daily Record pencil or my son's Poe Magnet Montessori pencils either. But we'll talk about all that and more in today's podcast. We're recording this on the off day after Game 2 of the World Series. Giants lead 2-0. If you listen to this podcast, you probably already know that.
I'm guessing that you probably might be aware.
We will talk.
They're playing the World Series?
We're taking your questions. We will talk about the Arizona Fall League some later in the podcast with an interview I recorded yesterday with Kyle Simon of the Phillies organization. Good stuff in there from Kyle about playing in the Fall League, about the University of Arizona, his alma mater, winning a national title the year after he left, and being Babe Ruff's roommate in AA Reading. So good stuff in that part of the podcast. Hope you enjoy the interviews. And but, J.J., obviously, the postseason's winding down. We've got Frank and Storm coming this weekend.
Early next week, especially.
Early next week, okay.
If you're in the Northeast,
it's affecting Jupiter now, the hurricane. Yeah. Hurricane Sandy's affecting Jupiter and the Rollwood Bat, the tournament down there, the big showcase. So it's already having an effect on the baseball world. But in this, since we're on this down day of the postseason, what's been your favorite moment or moments of the 2012 postseason? It's been a pretty eventful and entertaining month of October in baseball.
I got two. We were talking. One is watching Delmon Young attempt to play left field is entertaining.
That's entertaining / cringeworthy.
Yes.
It's like a bad train wreck.
Especially when you have the dichotomy of him versus Gregor Blanco, who Gregor Blanco seems to catch anything within a five-county radius of left field. But more seriously, I've been just impressed with – this has been, to me, when you say what will I remember about this postseason more than anything, something may change. I mean, we don't know that – you know, there may be a moment left in this. I mean, obviously we're going to remember Kung Fu Panda hitting three home runs in a game. Taking – Justin Verlander deep twice in the same game as part of a three-home run game. That will stick in the mind. But I'd say more than anything, it's just how getting down, you know, to must-win games has not really been that big of a problem in this postseason this year.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's one lasting image. It seemed like the most lasting image of the postseason in terms of a play was the Ibanez pinch-hit home run for A-Rod, because it was such a big deal at the time, A-Rod getting pinch-hit for. Then the other one is kind of the somewhat Tim Crumry-like flopping of Derek Jeter's left ankle. I mean, they're the Yankees. But that's a big deal. But that series in the big picture is
not an important series.
I think what the Cardinals did to the Nationals, and then what the Giants did to the Reds, and then what the Giants did to the Cardinals, those are more memorable. The National League postseason has been more memorable to me than the American League.
Because I think one of the key things is, at least how I go through these things, is I end up remembering a lot more about what happened to the teams who made the World Series.
Right, no
if
doubt.
If the two teams involved didn't make the World Series, I don't remember as much about it. I
mean,
I remember
Jeter and A-Rod are bigger deals than the average player.
Absolutely. And okay.
We're
Roy
not going to remember. We're not going to remember Coco Crisp's, walk off single against game tying single and then scoring the run for the A's. That's going to be forgotten. I guess I actually had the game winning single and Seth Smith scored. Anyway.
Right, but yeah,
I already can't remember it.
But I do think, though, the Pablo Sandoval's three-home run game, because I remember Reggie. I mean, that was probably, you're talking about first baseball memories I have, we're the same age.
I was trying to tell my son last night, or the day after, because he didn't stay up to watch that. He saw the first home run. I think he was reading in the second home run. But when I told him in the morning that there was a third home run, he instantly said, like Albert Pujols last year. And I said, well, that's what's crazy is that you're eight,
and
you think it's just common for someone to hit three home runs. Since you've been paying attention, it happens every year. And no, it's happened five times ever, and only two other people with Ruth and Jackson. And now it just happened to happen in each of the last two seasons with Pujols and Sandoval. But Pablo, the home run that Sandoval hit against the Reds, where he just jacked one, and then the home run in Game 7 by Brandon Belt, off Jason Mott, that sticks in my head as well. Flashes like that, but it's been a very entertaining postseason. JJ, we've got a lot of Twitter questions on our that we thought we'd also talk about today. But we did want to also talk in this podcast a little bit about the ongoing controversy in Pittsburgh, a team that is nowhere near the postseason, that threatened the postseason.
And then they tailed off two years in a row. To say tailed off doesn't really do it justice, because tailing off is like, oh, you fell short. Well, I mean, I think we said on a podcast at the end of July, well, at least the at least they're not going to have to worry about the streak, because there's no way you go from this to losing to a losing record, and we were wrong.
We were wrong, and, you know, I think that Dejan Kovacevic, our former correspondent, now the columnist of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, he was all in. Remember he had that column he wrote, like, in June or July, where he, like, this is the year. The Pirates have changed. Things are better. And then when that team went into that tailspin,
Dan, it was like, I don't want to speak for him, but having read his stuff,
right,
at the trade deadline, when they, as he saw it, and with some truth, didn't really do much.
And a big move was Travis Snyder.
Right. You know, which is basically, here, you can have our, you know, our problem. You can try to see if you can fix them. That was
their big move.
That's not a big move. You know,
right.
Obviously. Again, I think you can debate that point. Like, the Pirates, you can argue in some ways, were right in thinking, we're not really a playoff team. We've played over our head, and one move's not going to change us into a playoff team. That, if they had made that assessment, that would be some accuracy to that assessment. But
that's not how they played it at the time. They certainly didn't act like they saw the collapse coming, and neither did Dan. And then when the collapse came, he took it pretty hard, you know, and I think he took it hard because he felt like he'd been duped, and because their fans were taking it hard because they felt duped. And I think he felt like, when I'm reading what he wrote, he was kind of writing almost in a way as a fan and as someone who was trying to reflect the Pittsburgh sports fans' feelings toward that team. Which I think is a fair role for a columnist to play.
And so
there was some anger in there, I guess is what I'm saying. That's where I'm going.
The one of the biggest problems the Pirates have is that they have, understandably, the Pirates have no reservoir of goodwill.
They have no equity with their fans.
And they
should. Nor should they, exactly.
They should. If you don't win for 20 years, you do not have this spare reserve of trust us, we know, you know, what we're doing. And they have it worse in that they're doing that in the same town where the more popular team has that reservoir. If the Steelers came out and said, you know, we're not going to wear shoulder pads anymore, we think we're better off without them, fans would at least go, well, they do seem like they know what they're doing.
Right, exactly.
And the Pirates don't have that, and that leads into not just the Pirates,
but then there's the Penguins,
yes,
the hockey team, well, obviously not playing right now.
That's the big
but
problem.
They
that.
Do have, but still,
yeah,
though, that's a team, that's a franchise that has had two of the great players in hockey history in Lemieux,
absolutely,
and now Crosby, two guys who are faces of the sport. Got a new arena. They've won Stanley Cups 20 years ago. They've won Stanley Cups recently, or won Stanley Cup recently. So I think they won a Stanley Cup. Either way, they're competitive. They're good. The point, I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know my NHL Stanley Cup winners. I apologize.
Don't worry, right now there's not going to be one for 2013.
Right,
it looks like, so.
I'm sorry, Jim Schoener. But the point is, they're the. You could argue in some ways they're the number three franchise in town, in a three franchise town.
And this is the backdrop of what can only be described as a fascinating story. Because
it is fascinating.
So what, if you have somehow missed this, we'll give you the very short synopsis of it, which is that the Pirates player development side has very much bought in that they want to develop this team, this unified team, and the way to build that, there was an email that was leaked. A memo that was not supposed to be brought out publicly, but where Kyle Stark talked about that they wanted to be like hippies and Hell's Angels and all these different things all wrapped into one.
With a lot of motivational talk by their farm director, Kyle Stark, that was directed toward their coaches and, like, how do we want to handle our players in the second half of the season? What are we trying to get out of these players? And there was team building, it's bonding, but he used some catchphrases, and one of them, of course, was Hoka Hey.
That's the one.
It's a good time to die, which I believe is the Sioux, or I guess now they're known as the Lakota tribe. Rallying cry for Crazy Horse in the 19th century.
And then, with that, he also, Dan reported about how they had done Navy SEAL
type
training last year, which involve carrying telephone poles and, you know, running on the beach and things like that.
Non-traditional exercises and non-traditional baseball training. We'll put, that's an easy way to put
some
it.
Some hand-to-hand combat training and things like that. And then he's followed that up with, hey, they did that again this year. And then he followed that up further. And by the way, after the Navy SEAL training, they did this thing they called Hell Week, which is kind of taken from Navy SEAL training, where you deal with sleep deprivation and,
right,
you know, so they were woken up, the prospects in their
11:45 at night,
and
yeah,
taken out to go run for a couple of hours, and then, you know, they got up early again, so they were dealing with sleep deprivation. They
and played a game. Played a game that day.
Right. And did also some other non-traditional things, like running through sand pits and all kind of things. And with that, one of their prospects, Gregory Polanco, who, you know, if there's a Gregory Polanco fan club, I want to be near the top
that's
of
right.
that list.
That's right.
I'm all in on Gregory Polanco. But there was an injury, not a major injury. He's back playing. He's going to play winter ball. But there was
an aggravation of an earlier injury.
An aggravation of an earlier injury he suffered, which, again, just fed into the whole questions of this. And really, I do think I think what it comes down to here is that what we talked about earlier, the Pirates, the difficult thing for the Pirates, if the San Francisco Giants were doing this or the St. Louis Cardinals were doing this,
right,
it would be viewed as, look at this trailblazing organization who does things differently and they work.
Let's face it, the Cardinals are an organization. That's a great counterpoint team to bring up, because the Cardinals are a team that does have equity, not just with their fans, but in the industry.
Right.
And in the mid part of the last decade, they brought in Jeff Luhnow, and even though they had Tony La Russa, and even though they had Walt Jocketty as the general manager, Jeff Luhnow caught a lot of heat for doing things that, in the industry and out of it, for doing things that were not typical, that were not the industry norm. It wasn't just a Moneyball approach. He was just completely – there's no organization that really did Moneyball like the Cardinals. Not even the A's did Moneyball like the Cardinals. To the point that when ownership didn't like the way scouting and player development had been working with the general manager, and that there was this divide in the organization, they sided with Luhnow, not Jocketty, the
right.
guy who had, you know, won a World Series there in 2006, built the organization, been the guy who really brought in Tony La Russa. They sided with Luhnow and were validated with the team that won the World Series last year and that won a division series this year. So
and
with a lot of homegrown players. So Jeff Luhnow, though, had all that equity in an organization that had that equity. He didn't have the equity. The organization had it. But when that organization did things differently, they caught some flack and some ridicule. Now, most of it was directed at Luhnow. And he's kind of had the last laugh now, obviously, going on to Houston. So Pittsburgh has a lot less. So this story and these revelations, JJ, have kind of made them the laughingstock of the industry, and I think with good reason, because if you're going to – what Dayan pointed out, and he's pointed out very well, is that when you look at this team, the good young players on this big league roster were brought in by the previous administration. Dave Littlefield, as general manager – there's not really a lot of contributors from the Neil Huntington era, and they've been around since 2008.
Now, I'll say with that, we've had this debate in the office. I think because if you look at the top end of their farm system, it is significantly better.
I think their top 10 is going to be one of the best top 10s in the game.
Right.
When we have them all done, we're working on the handbook now. Next week's podcast, we'll talk about some American League East top 10s. We just put that issue to bed. But if you're looking at that, top 10 prospects, the Pirates' top 10 is loaded.
Right. And there's a mix there, really, of two things. One, of really expensive players who you can, if you want to be a critic, you can say, okay, yes, Garrett Cole's a good prospect.
But they spent $8
million
on him.
Jameson Taillon's a good prospect. They spent a ton of money on him. Mixed in with where they, you know, where if you want to give them some development success, mixed in with Alan Hansen's and Gregory Polanco's, who are Latin players who are very legit prospects who didn't cost them an arm and a leg to sign.
Right.
But if you want to criticize them, there's a very fair criticism, which is they spent a whole lot of money on a whole lot of guys who aren't very good prospects at all, either.
Absolutely true. The draft as a touchstone for them was the 2009 draft. Where they spent a ton of money. And the thing is, they get ridicule in the industry They've always got been in the industry, especially when you do. We talked about draft report cards last podcast. Other teams, when it comes to the draft prior to this new CBA, were very critical of the way the Pirates spent in the old CBA because Frank Coonerly, the team president, had been the guy who'd been the watchdog and he'd been the junkyard dog almost for Bud Selig, the guy who went after teams when they spent too much in the draft.
And then the
Pirates spent more than anyone else in the draft. I mean, like as Jim said, there's no team that's ever spent $13 million on two players in the draft like the Pirates did. And you spent $13 million on one with Steven Strasburg Nationals, but that was a special case. And the Pirates haven't gotten that kind of money. They haven't gotten that kind of bang for their buck with Cole and Bell yet the way that the Nationals did almost instantly with Strasburg.
Right, but I do think the reason they've been criticized in the industry has not been the Josh Bells or Garrett Coles. It's been the Zach Von Rosenbergs and it's been the million-dollar guys to me much more than the...
I will say that $5 million for a second-rounder is not something that the rest of the industry was too thrilled about.
I'm not saying... But Josh Bell... They may
have been seen as worth it, but that's $5 million for a second-round pick. From a precedence, I know what you're saying, like from the talent, maybe it was worth it.
Right.
But from a precedent standpoint, the rest of the industry frowned on that pretty hard.
I agree with that, but if I'm the Pirates, I don't care if the rest of the industry frowns on it from that standpoint if it makes me a winner.
Sure, but I think it points up the hypocrisy of Frank Coonerly. That's where I'm going.
But what I'm saying, though, is that if I'm the Pirates, yes, okay, it's... Frank Coonley's previous job was to do this, which was stupid.
Right.
And
right.
Just because in his previous job, the guy who signed his check said, you have to do this really dumb thing,
right,
doesn't mean that now that he's getting his check signed by someone else, he needs to continue doing the dumb
thing.
That
said, though, a lot of people thought that Zach Von Rosenberg was worth $1 million bonus and that Colton Kane was worth $1 million bonus. I don't think anybody thought that Josh Bell – I'm not trying to continue that argument, but that's kind of where I'm going. But that 09 draft, Tony Sanchez – Brooks Pounders, Evan Chambers, these kind of guys. You know, Vic Black, their supplemental first-rounder, he has a chance. But that was a bad draft. There's no other way around it. That was a bad draft. They're not going to get value out of that draft.
And their
farm system is thinner on talent at the top levels, even though they've had good teams the last 2 years at AA and AAA. They won the Eastern League in 2010. They had the best record, I'm pretty sure, in the International League in 2011, but Jeff Locke and Justin Wilson and Rudy Owens, those guys aren't going to change their franchise.
Right. They did trade away they got Wandy Rodriguez, which is another move I won't say they made at the deadline. They brought in Wandy. They traded away Robbie Grossman.
Good one, yep. I need to remember that.
But yeah, there's not a whole lot of guys, of impact guys, at the upper levels besides Garrett Cole. Their guys are mostly still a year plus away.
Yeah, the guy who was there, I mean, Tyone reached AA at the end of the year. Cole did as well and pitched in the AAA playoffs. And then Starling Marte was the impactful guy at the top, and that's an international signing. And they have made, I think we agree, between talking about Polanco, Marte, Alan Hansen, significant progress. But if there's a front office, there's been this week the Kenny Williams finally promoted to president of the White Sox, and Rick Hahn becoming general manager for the White Sox. There's been a lot of rumors about the Marlins this offseason and possible moves there. But it seems like with firing Ozzie Guillen, that's the direction the Marlins are going to go in as opposed to a front office shakeup. But this is the one to watch, I think, is that Bob Nutting says that he's evaluating. But I think Dayan, again, has kept on doing these stories in part because he wants to see some accountability from his standpoint. I don't think he's seeing any because it's almost like he's going to keep writing these until somebody's head rolls.
But the thing about this is that I think this is a key point. The Pirates, again, in the industry, the Pirates are looked at with this, and there are a lot of people in the industry who, I mean, I know I've talked to some people who say,
yep.
Oh, yeah, there are people laughing about this.
There's some SMH going on out there. You know, a lot of people shaking their heads.
And there's a lot of people saying, and again, part of this comes back to that whole, if you don't have that reservoir of credibility.
Right.
Some of the guys who are implementing these decisions were already considered by especially a lot of the old guard of baseball as controversial hires because it's like, okay, so Kyle Stark is, you know, running their farm system. What's his baseball background?
Right.
And it's pretty thin.
It's thin. That's right.
That he's part of the new wave of guys. You know, Jeff Lunau's baseball background is pretty thin.
Right, compared to, especially when he started.
Right.
Now it's
right.
a bit thicker.
But what I'm saying, though, is especially, though, these guys' baseball background, there are a lot of people in the game, you know, you can disagree or agree with this, but a lot of people in the game who's like, if you didn't play the game,
oh, yeah.
you do not understand parts of the game.
When the you parts do, that you'll never get.
And when you do something like this, that criticism's going to rise up a lot louder because it's like, if you think that carrying telephone poles on the beach is going
to
help you at Instructs, there are a lot of people out there in the industry who are like, you probably, you know, I've seen your teams play. You probably need to work more on turning the 6-4-3.
Correct. And that's where Dan was coming from because there was no talent at the upper levels that could help the Pirates this year down the stretch. And the guys who did come up performed skilled tasks poorly, base running, fielding, backing up plays, things that are learned, that are part of player development, were not done well.
And again, what it comes back to, though, is that it's going to take – and the Pirates organization believes in this, though. This
right.
is not
– They do. Absolutely, they do.
This is not one person having an idea and kind of pushing it through
right.
to the against the opposition of everyone else in the organization.
That's an important point.
That's an important point here because this is not something where Neil Huntington's going to wake up tomorrow and go, what are we doing?
Brother, you know, one other thing about their farm system, I don't know if you remember the 2010 draft was the one where they had Jameson Taillon, Stetson Alley, who's been in the news this year
That's
for
not good.
Them giving up on Stetson Alley as a pitcher, trying him as a hitter. He's not a top 30 guy. That was also the draft, I don't know if you remember, even at the time, they drafted right-handed pitchers in every round from round 1 through 12 with the exception of two outfielders, Mel Rojas Jr. and Dan Grovod. That was a bad draft at the time. I remember thinking, I don't care how your board lines up. I don't think I'd ever seen anything where a team just took the players at the same position over and over and over again. Every pick from rounds 4 to 10 was right-handed pitchers. I just remember the time just being it just stunned me that that was their approach. They didn't sign several of them. In the first 15, 16 rounds, they had four position players they signed. And Mel Rojas Jr., who was not good at the time and was a project at the time, is still a project. And so those two drafts are kind of lost. And we've talked about the Rays, JJ, about how we'll write about this a little bit more, I think, later, but just how, because we're still reporting it, but from 2008 on, they haven't drafted and developed a big leaguer yet. Every young player on their team, like a guy like Matt Moore, who's their big rookie this year, he was drafted in 2007. They have not had a player from their drafts from 2008 on reach the big leagues yet. The Pirates have had some, but boy, it's awfully small returns for the Pirates as well. Now, Brock Holt got to the big leagues pretty quick, but that's not who you really want to, I think, peg these things to.
Right.
And so that's the thing. When you're a low-revenue team, to me, when you're a low-revenue team like the Rays and like the Pirates, you just have so much less margin for error, and you can't blow two drafts in a row. You can blow one. Everyone can blow one. That happens. But when you blow two in a row, boy, that hurts. So
right.
2010, that whole draft right now is pretty much on Jameson Taillon's Canadian shoulders.
And the thing with that is that the Pirates' approach makes it more likely that they are going to – I mean, they're more likely to blow a draft than some other smaller revenue teams because their approach is a high-risk, high-ceiling approach.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, because, I'm
You're
working
right.
on the Reds list right now. The Reds pretty much never blow their first-round pick. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But the last – let's take Nick Travieso out of this right now because he basically hadn't pitched yet.
Right.
But – and if you want to say Robert Stevenson, too soon to know, you know, anything about him.
But early returns are pretty
early
good
returns
on
are
Robert
very
Stevenson.
Promising.
Yeah.
He's going to be a top 100 guy, I'll put it that way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But, okay, but so 2010, 2004 to 2010, every Reds first-round pick has already reached the big leagues.
Yeah, it's a good list. It's Homer Bailey, Jay Bruce, Drew Stubbs, Devin Mesoraco, Yonder Alonso, Mike Leake, Yasmani Grandal. It's a good list.
Every one of those guys, there's no one on that list you say, man, they just whiffed on that guy.
Takes me back to Chris Buckley when he was in part of what they did in Toronto, where they had a streak where Miguel Negron in 1999 is like the only first-round pick the Blue Jays drafted from like the late 80s through like 2004, 2005 that did not reach the major leagues. It's a long streak.
And what I'm saying is
Chris has been associated with a lot of successful first-round picks.
But the thing that stands out, though, is that the Reds is not as high ceiling a approach generally as the Pirates is, but it's also a much safer approach, and so they don't have drafts that you know, you go, ooh, that draft just...
Yeah, the riskiest pick in all those by far is Devin Mesoraco, because you're talking about a Northeast high school catcher, and the track record of high school catchers in the first round is brutal, frankly,
especially,
historically.
Yeah.
And Devin Mesoraco didn't have a great rookie year, but catching is hard. I think we still have confidence in him being better in 2013.
Right.
But yeah, that's a pretty impressive list. Actually, their 2003 also made the major leagues. Ryan Wagner.
Yeah, he made the major leagues, but
he's
already
out.
Say when you're a top 10 pick and you, I think, basically have 150 innings before you're done. You
right. He was the fastest member from the 2003 draft to get to the big leagues. That was a little bit different deal. But yeah, the Pirates don't have that. They don't have that history. They don't have that success. Those are stories. If you haven't read them, they're worth reading.
They have had some hits. Andrew McCutchen, they need franchise players. McCutchen is a franchise player. They acquired him first round, high school outfielder.
Tremendous player. What a fun player to watch.
Right.
He's so much fun. For him, I want the Pirates to be good because he is worth the price of admission. Pedro Alvarez, not a bust. I don't think he's been what they thought he would be, but... He had a better 2012 than, say, Eric Hosmer, the guy that always link it with.
And another thing with that is that was a low-risk pick.
Oh, no doubt.
That was a consensus college guy. If that guy doesn't work out, you can throw criticism if you want their way at the same time. That was no one when they picked him. People were going,
wow, what a bad pick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the guy did hit 30 home runs last year, so he's definitely not a bust. He struck out 180 times, so he's a – slightly thicker Curtis Granderson. Less home runs. I think he'd hit 40 home runs if he was in Yankee Stadium as well. But that's a fun discussion on the Pirates is a fun discussion as a whole. It's a fun organization.
Let's go to the questions.
Let's do it. Let's go start off with former BA intern Tim Ednoff. Why don't we do that? Timmy's out in Southern California. Asks, is there anything to the recent trend of hiring two batting coaches? More formality to something already in practice? And I wanted to ask that to you because the Royals are the organization that's recently done this, and you do the Royals top 30. How are they pitching this at the big league level?
I can see – okay, I'm trying not to be wishy-washy here, but let me first give you the arguments for and against. The arguments for are that one hitting coach at times gets – you know, there's only one guy to go around. Well,
he can be overwhelmed,
He can be overwhelmed because if you – there's only so many hours. You basically have – you can show up early, but there's only so many hours that you have to work in the cage and all before games. Because really the reality is that a hitting coach is – not that you're not doing stuff during the game, but the majority of your big work is going to be done pregame.
Right.
Working on things, you know, on the side work and all where you're working on, you know, okay, well, let's go inside to the indoor cage and let's work on this a little bit.
Yep.
That kind of thing. Having two guys basically doubles the – you know. Doubles the amount of guys you can have working on something. Hey, you're going to be working on that with him in the cage. You know, I'm going to be out here doing this, you know, working on a swing with someone else. That's the pro. The con is you better have two guys who – actually, I'll give one other pro first. The other pro is that hitting coach and hitter is a very much – the personalities and all do play a part in that. Because you're a psychologist also in part as a hitting coach.
Yep.
And – maybe by having two guys, some guys relate better to one guy, some guys relate better to another. That's another advantage. The disadvantage is you better have two guys who are very much on the same page.
Absolutely.
Because hitting coaches, good hitting coaches, usually have some pretty strong convictions about things. Your real danger here is if you have two guys who have strong convictions and what they're seeing are two different things, then – unless you basically divide it up and say, you got these guys, you got these guys.
Right.
You've got a real danger of screwing guys up because, well, you're telling me I'm dropping my elbow and that's my problem. And he's saying that my problem is that my base is not right.
They'll probably both see the same problem, but they may have completely different solutions.
You know what? You're a little too noisy in your setup. And the other guy's saying, you know, well, we got to open you up a little bit.
Yep.
Well, it may be starting from the same problem. You're having trouble, you know, handling something inside, you know, heat inside or something. But if you're getting two different answers, you may have some troubles there. So really, you got to stay on that. They've got to work together very well.
Yeah, I really wonder about it because I do think they can definitely have too many cooks. But to me, this is just part of a sports-wide trend. They're just more coaches, period. I mean, how many more coaches? I'm going to ask you a Steelers-centric question. JJ's a Steelers expert. In the mid-70s, how many assistant coaches did Chuck Noll have?
Half what they have now.
Yeah, I mean, and then you look at the you watch an NBA game.
There's an NFL team now, I believe, I can't remember who it is, who has 20 assistant coaches.
Yeah.
They have 53 players.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. If you watch an NBA game, sometimes there's six assistant coaches and 13 players suited up, or 12 players. I mean, it could be crazy. So in baseball, they still is a much smaller coach-to-player ratio. So to me, I can see it as a natural evolution of teams have more money and they have so much invested in the players, they want to provide more help. I do think there's a danger to it. I encourage it. I don't think it's bad. I think it's good for player development at the major league level. That continues at the major league level, and Lord knows the Royals need to develop their players more. So it makes sense, but I do think it's fraught with the peril that you mentioned.
But and where it really comes down to also, though, this is an extremely inexpensive way to, if you think
good
you're
going
to get a bump from it. An extra hitting coach, that's pocket change for MLB teams at this point. The same thing we've seen now, which I think we both agree is a great idea, is we're seeing more coaches at the minor league level.
And that is a great idea.
I mean,
I definitely
there's
agree
no
with that.
To, it's bad, you know. Now again, go back. If you're saying, hey, you know, I'm going to a minor league game and it's 1982.
Yeah, you have manager and maybe you have a pitching coach, but maybe not.
Right.
You might just have manager.
Your manager
and he does it all.
Right, and that was stupid.
Yeah, it was stupid. I love talking to – I love the story of Tim Corbin, now the coach at Vanderbilt, talking about his first head coaching job when he was at Division II Presbyterian. And he wasn't
my dad grew up in Clinton, South Carolina.
There you go. Well, he was not just the only coach on the staff. He was also his own groundskeeper. He did it all. And he also did all the laundry, and he made all the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches when they went on the road. He did
all of it. Gotta get the goober so you can, you know,
that's it. He talked about the goober grape. He did all of it. So it's obviously a little bit of apples and oranges talking about college, but
no,
yes.
But that is the thing. Is like you see this now at the minor league level where there are teams who have an additional pitching coach.
Yeah, the Yankees, I'm pretty sure this year, went to four coaches for all their minor league teams.
Which is smart because –
manager and three coaches, I mean to say.
Which I really think is smart.
I agree.
Because, for one, if in 2012, if you don't have at least one coach at each stop who's bilingual, you're screwing up.
Absolutely.
I really think
there are very few organizations where they don't need bilingual coaches, and I completely agree with you.
And that's so that's, you know, and
more likely to have a bilingual coach when you have four as opposed to three.
And I think so. That's one thing. But the other is that you're talking when you're down at the rookie levels. Like if you go to an Appy League game, the first thing that always stands out is there are a lot of players.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. There are like 35 guys crammed into those tiny little dugouts.
And it's like, and you need more coaches with that if you want to, because this is especially you're talking about levels where individual instruction is so important. Well, have more coaches to give that individual instruction.
Yep. No, I think we think it's a good thing. Let's go take some more of these questions and then wrap up and get to our interview with Kyle Simon. Roger Munter, big Giants fan, asks, Eastern League and Cal League lists and chats mention down years for pitchers. Is this a minors league, minors-wide phenomenon on a broad scale? Roger, I think just in turn, for me, talent was just down, period, in the minor leagues this year. But I thought that the pitching was actually pretty good. Just to seem like it was concentrated in some other leagues. I'm thinking like the PCL, the Southern League. Southern League was loaded with talent.
Pitching.
So I think it just really depends. I think these things are all cyclical and, you know, where the organizations have it. I do think overall talent in the minors is down compared to, say, a couple years ago or 3 years ago. But part of the reason for that is how much good young talent there is in the major leagues.
Come up very quickly in some cases.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think these things do go in cycles. But
the other thing with that is if you said ready, big league ready talent, I think I'd agree if he was down compared to what it was the last couple of years. At the same time, I do think that right now there are more hard throwers in the minors than we've ever seen.
I think I would agree with that. I think
there's more velo.
That's a whole different issue of pitching. I think that, you know, teams are – I do the Twins top 30. I did their draft report card. The Twins drafted, it seemed like, 15 college relievers, and they did like five high last year. And you just seem like you draft a lot more – I think it's part of the showcase culture. A lot more pitchers – pitch to the radar gun, try to throw hard, don't learn to pitch, they learn to throw, and they're a lot maybe they throw more innings, but they're a little bit more raw when they get to professional baseball than they used to be because their accent is on velocity, not on command, not on getting people out. And that's, you know, that's a bigger discussion. But I don't think pitching is down necessarily in the minor leagues. I think overall talent was a smidge down. Brian, don't call me Phil Koch, asks two Padres-related questions. Who do you expect the Padres to protect from the Rule 5 draft? And are they still a top 10 farm system with the promotions of Alonso, Grandal, Ed Ketera, and then all their injuries? JJ, are they still top 10 farm system? My gut feel is no.
I'd say no, too. And I think if you said, like, last year, not that we weren't high on the Padres, but I think we were a little more guarded about the Padres than maybe, you know, some other, you know,
I agree.
Prognosticators out there, in that from the standpoint of, we saw good depth, but there was a little bit more. I think that we had some concerns about, okay, so how many of these guys are really impact guys? And, you know, some of those guys are now up. I mean, Alonso, Grandal, you know, those guys like that. And some of, as he said, some of the guys got hurt. Robbie.
Yeah, we had him third. I mean, we had him high.
Yeah.
But we didn't have him number one, which I think a couple other people did. And, you know, Reimer Liriano, good year. Corey Spangenberg, not so much. Some good years for some of their lower-level guys, you know, the Austin Hedgeses and the some of those guys. But this is an organization that we talk about.
Joe Ross lost. Did not take a big step forward.
Yeah, he was good, but he wasn't great. I mean, he has flashes. But you want to talk about teams that have some holes in their farm system from drafts. You talk about, and also Rule 5 protection. 2008 and 2009, the thumbnail sketch for Rule 5 protection this year is 2008 high school guys, 2009 college guys.
With few exceptions.
From the draft. There are exceptions. But the only high school guy really fits that for the Padres is Jeff Decker. Jeff, don't call me Jeff Decker. And he did not have a big year this year. And then you're looking at their 2009, and they went in the other direction. They went a lot more high school. So the college guys, you know, really Nate Freiman, Jerry Sullivan, these are kind of their big decision guys. Jorge Reyes, I suppose. Matt Lawless.
The best way I can put it, I guess, is that there's no one you see on their list that you say, and, you know, Jeff Decker's really probably, and Nate Freiman are probably the two biggest decisions they have to make.
Yeah. None of these are guys other where you look at it, you boy, and you say, "Wow, that's a really tough shot, tough choice. I'd really hate to lose that guy." You know, none of these players. Now Matt Lawless is ranked high in the top 10. I know he's a Matt Eddie fave, but none of these guys. I don't think this is a year where they have really agonizing choices. And then of course Matt Lawless had the year that he had this year. I didn't realize he went 1-13. I knew it was a bad year. I've spoken with Matt about him. I didn't realize it was a 1-13 year. I didn't realize it was a year where his walk rate's over 4. So, you know, you want to try to Rule 5 that guy? Be our guest. That's kind of where I go. What else we have, JJ, on the question front?
Okay, so we've also got here from Tove Kalon, T-O-V-K-A-L-O-N, asking, does Tyler Austin look like a starting outfielder? May he help the Yankees in the near future?
That was the biggest decision in the Yankees' top 10 that I just finished. Yeah, they really have these four prospects in A-ball, three of whom they promoted together basically this year. Mason Williams, Gary Sanchez, Tyler Austin, plus there's Slade Heathcott. So all four of these guys played in Tampa. You had them all in the Florida State League. Mason Williams didn't qualify. But I think in the leagues where we had three multiple Yankees, Tyler Austin was at the front of all of them. But I did not have him at the front of that list.
Which I can understand.
You know, and it's a tough, to me, the consensus seemed to be that he had the lower ceiling but the higher floor than all these other guys. To me, Tyler Austin fits in as an everyday regular. I do think he's a future regular. I think the question is how much impact. Is this a 20-home run guy? Is this a 25-home run guy? Is he a 15-home run guy? I don't think anyone sees him as a 30-home run guy.
Right.
The range is somewhere from 15 to 20, 20 to 25. In those years where he's 15 to 20, you're basically describing kind of a right-handed Nick Markakis. You're talking about a good player, but not an impactful all-star player.
And
you're looking at 20 to 25, then you're talking about a profile right fielder.
And that's really the question. And
it is.
It's very difficult when you're talking about a guy who is, you know, who's really an A-ball still.
Right. Did finish the year in Double-A, but yeah. I mean, he'll probably start next year in Trenton, but so will Ramon Flores, who's another prospect they like. So will Slade Heathcott. And then right behind them will be Mason Williams. And as soon as Mason Williams masters Tampa, he's going up to double A somewhere. Maybe Ramon Flores goes back to first base, which he's played, you know, in the past. So it's
Ramon Flores hopes this is maybe by then he's ready for triple A.
That's possible. Or maybe Tyler Austin goes to first base. Because Tyler Austin, I talked to a couple people in the organization who think that Tyler Austin, while he's a solid right fielder, could be a very good first baseman. Even though the arm strength is above average.
If I'm Tyler Austin, I'm sure hoping they're not putting me at first base. Because if they put me at first base, your options then are trade bait, hang out in the AAA for a long time, or DH.
Well, the thing is, it's not like Mark Teixeira, while he's signed for a long time, it's not like he's very good anymore. He's a 250 hitter. He's a slightly higher average, lower home run version of Curtis Granderson. The Yankees have some... they have some serious issues as far as those things go, because even though they scored a ton of runs this year, there's some downward trends for a lot of those players.
A lot of downward trends.
So, the consensus in the Yankees organization last year was that Tyler Austin could play the outfield but was better suited to first base. I still think that the consensus is that he is better in the outfield than they thought, but I think he could be really good at first base. So, and they have a crowded outfield. So we just mentioned those four guys, plus they have a young big leaguer in Brett Gardner, who's their only young big leaguer, really, now that Cano is 30. And they have Granderson. I know he had a terrible postseason and he hit 230, but he did hit 40-plus home runs for the second straight year.
They've already come out and said,
yep.
You know, how many center fielders hit 40 home runs a year? So
not very many. Not very many. And the other wild card in all this is Mikiltadek Mesa. I mean, I don't think Melky Mesa is a regular. But he is a wild card. He got a lot better this year. Juan Dominguez also asked JJ a couple questions for Winter Ball. Juan is in Venezuela and has actually written a story for us in the past. He wants to know what Joe Ortiz's problem is. He said he's been very erratic, nasty slider, outstanding sinker at times, superb control. This is the 5'7" left-hander of the Rangers organization. And that's why I brought it up. We just talked about him today in regard to the Rangers top 30. He's on the cusp of making the Rangers top 30. And he kind of fascinated us last year in the South Atlantic League and the Florida State League. Is this guy the next Tim Collins? I'm saying that because they're both 5'7" and left-handed.
I say no.
Or is he the next Danny Ray Herrera?
No.
Okay. He's a hybrid of the two?
He's in between. Okay. I don't think his – I mean, when because – well, that's a pretty – I mean, those guys are both short.
And left-handed. And
left-handed.
Otherwise, they're not alike at all.
But
and they're human.
They both sleep, they both eat, Tim Collins is this really small guy who throws heat, and that's really kind of his calling card, is he's always generated a lot of strikeouts. Danny Ray Herrera is really small, and he always has had the thing, he's had this, you know.
Change up off a change up.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so you're ready looking for my change up? Well, I'm going to do my change up. It's too slow for you to be ready for my change up. Okay, now I'm going to sneak my fastball by you. Now change up. So I don't think Joe Ortiz is that or that. I think he's more of, he's the kind of guy who, you know, I think he could be a useful left-on-left option, you know, in small doses, But I don't see him. I don't see him ever having a bigger role than that for the Rangers.
I agree, and that's a tough organization to make the top 30 in. But
it is.
He's given it a whirl, and at any height, that's still one of the deeper top 30s.
I'm very bummed. Johan Yan did not make a pitch for that this year, and one of my favorite Rule 5 sleepers last year.
He's turned into the Latin American version of Danny Farquhar. They have lots of arm slots and not a lot of strikes coming out of those. Interesting stuff, but I just wanted to say Farquhar. Let's face it. Anything else, JJ? I think I'm ready to go.
I think it's ready to listen to Kyle Simon.
We're going
to
move on to Kyle Simon. If you have questions for us, as always, you can send it to us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. You can tweet them at us at JJCoop36. At John Manuel BA. And if you have suggestions for who you'd like us to try to interview, as we try to keep these prospect interviews going, let us know at those email addresses or Twitter handles. Now listen to Kyle, and we'll sign off for this part of the podcast.
We had Cody Decker of UCLA fame on the show a couple of weeks ago now in the Padres organization, so we're going to keep it in the Pac-12 family with our second player guest, and that's Kyle Simon. Now, the Phillies organization, but formerly of the University of Arizona, Kyle joins us from the Arizona Fall League. Kyle, how's it going today?
Pretty good. How you doing, John?
I'm good, and I think we both stayed up probably a little bit later than we needed to last night to watch the World Series, but that was entertaining. But I wanted to start off talking to you about the College World Series because your alma mater won the College World Series this year. University of Arizona Wildcats, first national title since 1986. You play with some of those guys. I believe your junior year would have been the freshman year for the Mejias, the Mejias Breens, the Kurt Hayers, all those kind of guys. What was that like from afar? How much did you follow that team, and what was it like kind of being an alum and someone who played in the program, watching guys that you know win a national title like that?
I mean, I was actually drafted the year before, so they're all sophomores.
Okay.
When I was playing, it was special to see. I mean, those guys definitely earned it. Them coming into the program, they definitely had an impact on everything, and to watch them play on TV was pretty sweet. I mean, proud of those guys. I mean, definitely envious, but I mean, the rate I'm going in my baseball career, I would rather. I mean, I can't have any regrets. So,
right.
I'm pretty excited for them, but I'm pretty excited for myself also.
Yeah, that's what confused me. I mean, first year in pro ball and traded for a future Hall of Famer in Jim Thome.
Yeah.
And then already finishing the year in Double A, kind of a whirlwind, I guess, for you this year. How many? What would you wear? Two or three different uniforms this year? Now in the fall league, probably four.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in about three or four different leagues now, and it's like a kind of a culture shock. I mean, I'm not used to it, but I mean, I'm getting used to it, and it's just the game I love, so I'm really excited to play, and especially getting traded. I mean, it was just a better opportunity for me because I kind of was slumping a little bit with the Orioles, and I get picked up in that trade, and I've kind of turned it around, done a whole 360 coming out of the pen, and doing good for the Phillies, so I'm just excited to go to work for them.
Yeah, you started the year in Frederick, then Clearwater and Reading after the trade, and like you said, switched from rotation to the bullpen. I think it's a generic question. I'm sure you've been asked about it a lot, but for you, with that change, I mean, obviously it changes your mindset, but did you change your repertoire at all when you went into the bullpen? Did you focus? Did you kind of go from maybe four pitches to two or three?
It's definitely a mindset with the whole starting role. I never understood it. I mean, in college, I really flourished and did it well. But once I came to pro ball, it was kind of a different story because you had to pitch every fifth day. My arm really wasn't ready for it kind of thing. And coming out of the pen, I just love it. Get to hang out in the bullpen the whole game and tell jokes and hang out with all the guys. And then eighth or ninth inning comes around, and then you're in the game, and it's kind of the clutch situation. So your adrenaline's pumping, and you get to come and it's with starting. You kind of have to hold back a lot of things because I mean you have to get through about the fifth or sixth inning with relieving. I kind of just come in, just throw my hardest, and then I'm out in a matter of two or three innings. So I enjoy relieving a lot more. And, with the pitches, you don't have to, I mean, you can come at them with everything rather than having to start them off with a fastball and then the second time through the lineup, throw in your slider and change up. So it's definitely a fit for me.
Yeah, and we're tying it into the World Series. I mean, we just saw in game one last night, you know, a guy like Tim Lincecum, again, keep it in the Pac-12, but a guy like Tim Lincecum who, won a couple of Cy Young Awards and led the major leagues in strikeouts. But obviously struggled a little bit this year, but now in the postseason in the bullpen, you can kind of see with him what you're talking about. I mean, do you watch that as a pitcher? When you're watching a game like that, do you watch the pitchers more? And what could you see that really with Lincecum, the way he attacked out of the bullpen last night? Just seemed like he's freer and easier just pitching out of the bullpen.
I mean, it seems like I watch more baseball than I actually play. I mean, I play a lot of baseball, and I watch quite a bit of baseball. It's kind of like our homework, I guess. Because, I mean, critiquing these guys, we're going to be playing with them in the next few years. So you kind of got to get an understanding of how to pitch to them, how to do all that. And if you're behind on that, you're gonna get hit around a little bit, especially in the pros.
I like that idea of kind of using it as homework. One of the stories we're actually working on, right now in the office, we just finished putting it in the magazine, was about the Detroit Tigers, when they had this layoff between, I'm sure you read about it, instructional league team up to the big league park, and I direct message an email with a couple of those players. They talked about kind of what you're talking about. It was Jeff McVaney, who was a first baseman out of Texas State, who just told me, yeah, I mean, you know, the main thing I got out of it was watching those guys be pros, just watching the way they comport themselves. I don't know if there are any guys in your, like on your fall league team who kind of fit that same mold. Guys have been in the big leagues. But if you noticed that as a difference, whether it was in spring training or in the fall league, because it really seems like that's one of the things that struck these instructional league guys was, the preparation level was a little bit different for the big leaguers than maybe they were used to.
Yeah, I think the best, experience I got this year was, when I was in Clearwater, about right after the trade, Roy Halladay had a spot start after his rehab, and watching him go out about his business before that, and then he bought us filet mignon after, which was pretty ridiculous. But I mean, just watching him be him, and then I mean, after he got out, he came back, finished a little bullpen, and then he shook everybody's hand in the bullpen, said good luck this year. I mean, he just a total professional, and I'm pretty excited to play with him hopefully in this upcoming year.
Yeah, I mean, his reading Dirk Hayhurst's book, Roy Halladay's preparation is legendary. I mean, that's kind of what's made him Roy Halladay. We're talking with Kyle Simon of the Philadelphia Phillies organization. Kyle was traded this year from the Orioles to the Phillies. Let me ask you a couple things about this season. You started off in Frederick. You just mentioned Roy Halladay. I want to ask you about a couple other players. So you were in the Orioles organization. You got to see some Dylan Bundy up close, and I guess you got to play with Manny Machado. I just was writing about Yankees top 10 and this guy Mark Montgomery, who's a closer. I think he's out in the fall league. On the cusp of the Yankees top 10, he gave up one home run. Now, he's given up one home run in pro ball over the Manny Machado on a night when Machado hit for the cycle. I mean, we all got to see Machado. Again, you watch a lot of baseball. I guess you probably weren't surprised at all to see what he did in the big leagues and how different of a pitcher, when he showed up as a teenager in Frederick, how different was Dylan Bundy? Or was he not really that different? Was he just a very good player? From a player perspective, how different those guys are?
Yeah, I've never seen such a polished high school guy. Because, I mean, me coming out of high school, I really had no idea. I mean, I knew going to college was going to be my best bet if I wanted to further my career in baseball.
Yeah.
Especially with Andy Lopez coaching. But, I mean, this guy, I've never seen a guy like him. He's basically fully well-rounded, knows how to attack hitters, has the stuff to be in the big leagues right now. I mean, he already is, but I mean, he's a phenom. I got him throwing, him doing his workouts. The guy has a bigger legs than I have a waist kind of thing. I mean, the guy's pretty incredible work ethic. Just in terms, I mean, a good guy in general. He kind of hasn't, I mean, he hasn't necessarily grown up. He's only like a 19-year-old kid, but I mean, it's soon going to hit him that he's just a superstar. But I mean, he's got the right head on his shoulders. I mean, he's going to be hopefully a Hall of Famer. I mean, the guy's incredible to watch, and to see fire flames come out of a 5'11 body is pretty special.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear he's worthy of the hype. Did you play with Machado at all, or maybe just an instructs last year?
No, just an instructs. He was in Double A once he started the year, so I was still on high.
The guy that you play with this year that beyond Bundy that had the most special year was Darren Ruff. You finished in Reading, and you dealt. I want to talk to you about kind of being a sinker ball and the ground ball rate that you had this year. But Darren Ruff, there's a guy who it didn't seem like sinkers, four seamers, it didn't seem like it mattered. You ever seen a guy that locked in like Darren Ruff was?
I actually had this because they made Babe Ruff shirts.
Yeah,
I had a shirt hanging up in my room, but once I got moved up to Double A and. It was right before August, so I mean that was right before the month he hit about 20 home runs, so it felt like every game he was hitting a home run. But I mean, he was my roommate, same type of guy, just super laid back in the Midwest. But I mean, he was just a special guy to watch, and it was fun to be around, especially in the playoffs and everything. But I mean, just a good guy in general. I mean, he's tearing it up in the Venezuelan, I think, or the one of those leagues down south. But just a super one of those guys you wanna pitch for and you wanna play for, because just an all around good guy.
Excuse me. It sounded like it really was. The thing about it was, like you said, you mentioned the T-shirt you had hanging up.
Yeah.
It really seemed like with a crazy ostrich guy, all those kind of things. Reading is already kind of a fun place to play, but it seemed like the team embraced it, the franchise embraced it, the fans. It seemed like that was just a fun. Had to be a fun month, and also I'd imagine a fun month for you because again, you were really thriving in that role. I think you only had one or two, really two outings the whole month of August where you gave up a run. So
yeah.
Was that one of the more fun months of baseball for you, especially as a professional?
Yeah, I mean, making playoffs with that team too. I mean, came down to the last game, but at the same time, it was definitely fun to pop champagne in Portland, Maine, and destroy their locker room and everything. So I mean, it was a good time.
That's always the worst hope, the worst fear, I think, of home teams is have a visiting team clinch, because just from a minor league standpoint, those minor league teams, they got to pay all that money to repair the clubhouse you guys ruined. But it sounds like a fun time.
Oh yeah, we definitely did some damage, but it was good.
Well, I want to talk to you about you as a player. I mean, your reputation has always been, we've written about you in college, pro ball, sinking the baseball, your career ground ball flyout ratio, according to our numbers, is close to 5 ground outs for every flyout. For you, is it a matter of, have you always been able to sink the baseball? Kind of where did that, when did that develop for you in your career, and what do you attribute that ability to?
I was actually throwing a bullpen my junior year in high school, and one of my assistant coaches, who coaches for Paramount High School in Southern California now, he kind of showed me the grip of the two-seam that I still throw today, and he said, just throw this, and I threw that one pitch, and it moved about 3 feet, so decided to stick with that the rest of my career. And I mean, I've been throwing nothing but a two-seam fastball because of my arm angle and everything. It just creates a lot of movement and downward torque that guys really can't hit in the air. So, I mean, it's helped out quite a bit. It's a little bit different out here in Arizona because the air is dry. Like, I had to deal with it in college and everything. But once you move to the East Coast with humidity, it moves about, seems like, a foot or two more and just pretty unhittable to hit.
So playing on the East, so getting drafted, even though you're a SoCal guy, born in Long Beach. So even though you're a SoCal guy, going to the East Coast is probably a good thing for your career, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, coming, you kind of take it as you got a 50-50 chance to either be in Arizona or Florida the first time around, and I got the lucky side of being in Florida, and then getting traded, same thing, and boom, another Florida team, so... I mean, there's no distractions over there, which is nice. I mean, I'm not too familiar with people over there, and I know some buddies here and there, but at the same time, if I was going to be in the California League, it'd be somewhat of a distraction to be out there and all my buddies be around and have a lot of people come to the games and stuff. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, but at the same time, it's more focused out in Florida. I can get my work done.
Well, the Fall League always sounded like, you mentioned distractions. The Fall League sounds like it always can be a distraction. I mean, you went to college in Tucson, which is a little bit down the road, obviously, from Phoenix. But, I mean, what does the Fall League compare to in terms of that kind of off-field or that kind of distraction? Is it kind of like a Cape or a summer college league as far as that baseball? What's it like for you?
I would describe it as Cape. I mean, it's just a bunch of the most elite players. I mean, we don't really have agendas other than having a game at 12 every day, getting done around 4, and then we have from 4 till the next day to do whatever we want. I mean, being in Peoria, it's kind of a ways to Scottsdale and Mill Avenue, but at the same, where all the, that's like the hot spots.
Sure.
But I mean, we still have our fun. I mean, we tend to have a lot of barbecues at our house, and for NFL Sunday, and we have Sundays off, so that's even better too. But I mean, it's just more of it's the most relaxed league I've ever played in, especially with the talent that everyone has, because I mean, everyone's coming off a 5-month season and kind of just gearing down for off season. So I mean, everyone wants to perform, but at the same time, everyone wants to just be healthy and go into off-season just healthy and ready to recover for the next year. So, I mean, it's a fun league. You get hit around quite a bit sometimes, but, I mean, it's an offensive league. I mean, they told us at the get-go because of the strike zone. The strike zone's going to be small, so you're just going to have to pound the zone and let them do their thing. And luckily, with my movement, it gets guys out a lot, except for that first outing.
I wasn't going to bring it up if you didn't.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that first outing, you didn't make out of what the first inning. But then your third outing was at three scoreless innings. I mean, was that first outing just kind of like almost a little bit of a wake-up call? Like, okay, wait a minute, this talent out here is extreme, and that you're going to have, you know, that you, like you said, that your sinker wasn't going to sink as much, and then it was going to be a matter of making adjustments after that.
I mean, that day was kind of just baseball. I mean, they had some breaks, and I gave up some hits, wasn't locating my ball like I wanted to, and it was kind of the first live hitting I've seen in about a month since Reading. So, I mean, when you get thrown into the fire and you're thrown against the best hitters in the minor leagues, it's sometimes tough to get an out.
All right.
So, I mean, it was a struggle, but I mean, it's kind of not how you start, it's how you finish. So hopefully I'll finish strong, and I mean, that's what I did in this season. So I mean, I'm just looking forward to the next outing on Saturday.
I think it has to make every pitcher feel a little bit better about themselves. You see Justin Verlander, probably the best pitcher in the world, get hit like he got hit in game one of the World Series. If that can happen to him, it can happen to anybody. And then, like you said, it's how you get back. What you do in reaction to that kind of tells a little bit more about who you are, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Kyle, good stuff today. Appreciate you being patient with us and our technical issues, but enjoy talking with you, and finish strong out there in the Fall League in the next 3 to 4 weeks. Look forward to following your progress.
Sounds good. I appreciate it, John.
Thank you. Kyle Simon of the Philadelphia Phillies organization.